Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Briley, your host for the show that brings different perspectives together every week here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. And I have another fascinating interaction for you today. Larry Hurtado and Tom Holland are my guests on the show today. I'll be introducing them and what they're talking about in a moment's time. But it's always great to feature interesting conversations on the show. If you want to go back and look through the vast back catalogue of programmes that you can listen to, then go to our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Lots of people subscribe via the podcast and download shows that way. Over 9 or nearly 10 years now of shows available. The show's been going over 10 years, but we haven't been podcasting quite that long. But nonetheless, a huge back catalogue that you can avail yourself of if you want to. And if you are listening on something like iTunes, why not rate the show? I understand that that's a good way of making it appear to more people so that they're more likely to come across it if they're looking for podcasts. So why not go and rate the show? Tell other people about it. Send the link on to a friend, that kind of thing. Again, all the links available as ever from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And while you're there, you can have a browse of the Unbelievable Conference on DVD and digital download. We were in London this year on Saturday, the 2nd of July, talking about how you can become a more confident evangelist. And fantastic guests joined us, including Jay John, Gary Habermas, and a whole host of other Christian thinkers and speakers. You can watch the whole day on DVD and audio CD, or indeed download it as a digital download. All the options available there from the website. Again, just click through to the Unbelievable website and you'll see it there. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Got a few events that I'd like to tell you about a little later on today's show as well. Had quite a few events of one kind or another recently in the show, and we've got an event coming up on Interfaith Week that you may be able to attend in London, and there's also an exciting biology conference, and we'll be hearing from some of the speakers a bit later on today's programme. But right now, let's meet today's guests.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the show, why I changed my mind about Christian history. Tom Holland is a historian whose books on ancient empires such as Rubicon, The Triumph and Tragedy of the Roman Republic, and In the Shadow of the Sword on the Rise of Islam have been bestsellers. Most recently, he published Dynasty, The Story of the Rise and Fall of the House of Caesar. And he's working on a new book, which I'm looking forward to him telling us about. In a recent article for The New Statesman, Tom explained why he has changed his mind on Christianity, how he came to regard it as unique in its time and central in many ways to the development of modern Western values and morality. Well, in today's show, he's interacting with Larry Hurtado, emeritus professor, I should say, of New Testament language, literature and theology at the University of Edinburgh. And Larry's new book, Destroyer of the Gods, tells the story of the uniqueness of Christianity in its first century context. Well, I know both are fans of each other, so I'm looking forward to a very collegial kind of discussion on the issues today. We're going to be addressing popular criticisms that Western culture owes just as much to the Greeks and other cultures as Christian, and whether Christianity was responsible for things like the Dark Ages. These are some of the popular notions and objections levelled at this aspect of history. So, Tom and Larry, welcome along to the programme.
Hi there.
Great
to have you both on. Tom joining me here in the studio, Larry on the line from Edinburgh. Tom, first of all, it's super lovely to have you in the studio because I've often read your articles and the books and seen you. You're quite prolific on Twitter, talking as much about cricket as history, I think.
Prioritise the important things.
you're not afraid of occasionally stirring up a bit of interest and controversy. I remember a few years ago, the talking point was your programme for Channel 4 on the history of Islam and so on. But where does your passion for these historical events and times and so on come from?
Right the way back to my childhood. I was one of those boys who was very, very into dinosaurs, which we may well come on to, because I think that the relationship of dinosaurs and the Garden of Eden is a well-trodden issue in this
indeed,
field.
Indeed.
But the reason that I loved dinosaurs was that they seemed more exciting than the world that I was growing up in. They were big, they were glamorous, they were fierce, and they were extinct.
Mm.
And so it fueled my imagination. And essentially, my interest in the great empires of the ancient world was a natural corollary of that. My interest bled naturally from tyrannosaurs to the Roman legions or the Assyrians.
Mm.
And when I write about them now, although I obviously try and be as absolutely true both to the primary sources and the current state of academic thinking on these areas. Nevertheless, I always try and tend the kind of the flame of my childhood passion, because that really, I hope, is what animates the books that I then write about them.
Well, I know that your books are always so interesting because you do get that sense of the passion coming through and so on. I mean, you've made it your lifetime's work in that sense, talking about ancient empires of Rome and Greece, Persia and so on. But your thinking about those and the way they play into history and where we are today in, if you like, Western civilization has changed over time. This is what you were describing in the article. Do you want to just give a very brief outline of that?
Well, I was asked for the New Statesman. It was part of a series on things that I've got wrong. And I think that this is
not just you, other people.
Yeah,
too.
Other people. So, yeah, people talking about the Iraq war and modernist fiction and a whole range of things. But this, to me, seemed probably the biggest adjustment in my thinking that I've done over the course of writing the books that I have done. And they're not just about the ancient world. So the first book I wrote about the age of Julius Caesar. The second book I wrote about the Persian Wars, so the Battle of Thermopylae, Salamis, so on. And what I felt on the kind of gut, emotional, visceral level while living, trying to live in the heads of Spartans and Romans, was a sense of how very alien they were and how very frightening, in a glamorous way. I mean, in an exciting way, in the way that kind of stirred me, in the way that I would, you know, if I watched a Tyrannosaur being recreated in Jurassic Park or something. But not the kind of people in whose society I would particularly want to live.
Yes.
And I realised that the chasm that separated me from Leonidas or Caesar was essentially an ethical and a moral one. And therefore, I became very interested in what is the nature of that chasm and how did we cross it in terms of people living in the West? And so the third book I wrote was a study of the 10th and the 11th centuries in Latin Christendom. Because I had come to the conclusion that the great rupture in Western history was not so much the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. It wasn't so much the societal and economic collapse that had brought about. It was a moral and ethical transformation. And that really was the profound change. And so, oddly, I then wrote an article. Whenever you do a book, you do publicity, you tend to say that the book you've written about is the most important field possible. So when I wrote a book about the Romans, I say the Romans are absolutely crucial. Right, the Greeks, absolutely crucial. I wrote about, and the conclusion that I'd come to in writing this book about particularly the 11th century papacy, the figure of Gregory the Seventh, this astonishing pope who is emblematic of this revolution at the heart of Western society that essentially saw the difference between church and state enshrined at the most fundamental level. And that seemed to me to constitute perhaps the defining feature of Western society. And everything that follows from that, the very notion of secular identity seems to me to follow from that. Yeah. And the idea that the godfather of that should have been a medieval pope is sort of one of history's wonderful ironies. And I wrote an article again for the New Statesman making this case, saying that essentially our society, our modern Western secular, indeed agnostic society, was nevertheless shot through with its foundations in the assumptions of Latin Christendom. And whereas no one had complained at all when I made high claims for the Romans or the ancient Greeks, the reaction to this was absolutely vituperative. And I realised that there is a huge difficulty in writing about medieval Christian civilization in a way that there isn't writing about pre-Christian empire.
Okay. Where's that coming from?
Well, on the one hand, there are, of course, people who remain Christian for whom this is more than simply a historical issue. But on the reverse side, there are also people who have an almost similarly theological level of opposition to that idea. Their identity is powerfully tied up with the notion that the Enlightenment and everything that the Enlightenment bred is a reaction against what went before.
Right.
And, of course, to me, it seems clear that the Enlightenment is as much a myth as any other great trend. I mean, the very idea, you know, the very notion of the Enlightenment is shot through with Christian ideas. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light.
Is there a sense in which that's become something of a secular myth then,
yes,
a modern myth?
Absolutely. And so it's very, very, it's obviously far harder to write about Christian or indeed Muslim history, the history of faiths that are still practiced, than it is about societies where those gods are dead.
Have died out, sure. I want to come back to you because I'd be interested about the personal dimension of that as well for you. But we must introduce Larry, who's our other guest on the programme today. Larry Hurtado, as I said, Emeritus Professor of New Testament, Language, Literature and Theology at the University of Edinburgh. Still producing books, your latest, Larry, Destroyer of the Gods, is on the uniqueness of Christianity in its first century context. And I saw Tom's article and I saw your book, I thought this could be an interesting matchup here. Larry, you've spent your life detailing early Christianity, studies in Paul, lots of stuff. What made you want to write this particular book, though, on the place of early Christianity in its context?
Well, I guess there are two reasons. One is within the field of investigation of early Christianity, particularly. Not so much actually in the wider ancient historical circles, but in the circles of people I tend to drink with more often in the study of early Christian origins, there seemed to me to be a tendency to emphasize, quite justifiably, ways in which early Christianity was very much a part of its Roman setting, very much partook of customs and, in some senses, ideas and so on of the time. But there was often, it seemed to me, a failure to indicate at the same time that it was also distinctive in a number of important ways. And indeed, you know, some scholars find it difficult to detect a distinguishable Christianity, believe it or not, in the first two or three centuries. They say, well, there really isn't a Christianity identifiable as such, really, until quite late. And it was always curious to me because when I read the ancient pagan sources, they seemed quite able to say there were these people called Christians and they were able to identify them quite readily and attribute to them features which they regarded as distinguishable and even objectionable. So part of what I was up to was to try to kind of balance out things and say early Christianity, yes, very much was a Roman era religion in the early centuries, but it also had some really peculiar, distinctive, in the eyes of some people, even bizarre features. That was one thing. I had a second reason as well, and that was that I think that more generally in the wider public, for whom the book is actually primarily written, there is this sense that all religion is basically sort of just different flavors of the same thing, that the differences between or among religions is relatively insignificant, that there's a common thing called religion, which is pretty recognizable wherever you find it, with minor tweakings. And so I wanted to say, no, actually, the things that we lump under the category of religion include quite a number of incommensurate things, things that just are very, very different from one another. And more particularly, the distinctive features of early Christianity in the first couple of centuries have subsequently become cultural commonplaces for us, such that we don't recognize where they come from. So the opening line in my book is, this book addresses our cultural amnesia, ways in which features that distinguished early Christianity in the Roman setting, subsequently in at least European and European-influenced cultures, have become cultural commonplaces.
Well, that's set the stall very nicely for today's show. And I'm looking forward to having this conversation with Tom Holland and Larry Hurtado. If you'd like to get in touch yourself about anything you hear on today's programme, why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you enjoy these kinds of shows, do check out the range of other programmes we have. We have people from all walks of life and all kinds of specialities joining me on the show to discuss these kinds of issues. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find us, of course, on Facebook and Twitter and all the links available from the webpage there.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So today on the programme, we're talking about why Tom Holland changed his mind about Christian history. He wrote about this in the New Statesman recently. Tom is a historian whose books on ancient empires such as Rubicon and In the Shadow of the Sword have been bestsellers. He's working on a new book. I understand, Tom, that you're currently writing a book which will kind of very much expand on that New Statesman article about the...
I've just begun.
Right.
It's alpha, not omega, unfortunately.
We won't see it for a while.
Not for a while, no.
But I hope to have you back on when it is available. I don't know whether you've had a chance to read Larry's new book.
I have, yes, I have.
What was your takeaway from what Larry said, and how does it kind of come into contact with what you're doing?
I found it absolutely incredibly reassuring, to be honest, that a scholar as great as Larry should have be setting out things that I, in my own groping way, had come to in a very similar manner. And the aspect of it that I think I found most reassuring and interesting was when he talks about the distinctive Christian understanding of the risen God. Because there is, ever since Fraser and the Golden Bough, there's been this kind of assumption that there is nothing particularly exceptional about the figure of Jesus as a God, that this is part of a cultural matrix in the Near East, that gods are dying and rising from the dead. And Larry, in a very forensic manner, demonstrates that that is not true. And as Larry has illustrated in other books as well, there is something incredibly weird about the notion that a crucified slave should be enshrined as someone, you know, whether he's enshrined as a god immediately or gradual process. It is astonishing, and I think that our familiarity with the crucifixion, with the passion narrative and the figure of Christ on the cross has dulled us to just how astonishing this is, because crucifixion was regarded with such horror by the Romans that actually the gospel accounts are pretty much the only account of the process that we have.
Yeah, they're our main source for what happened.
And the Romans regarded it with such disgust that they were not even willing to acknowledge their own role in propagating it. They liked to sort of blame the Carthaginians or the Persians or the Gauls for it. So you get a sense there of the visceral cultural horror with which crucifixion was regarded. And that's clearly one in which Jews shared as well. And so the idea that someone who had suffered that fate could then be enshrined, not just as a god, but as the only god, the god who had fashioned everything, is a paradox so unexpected and so profound that I think it's only by recapturing a sense of the initial shock that people would have felt at that you can get anywhere close to understanding what was seismic about Christianity in the context of its birth, but also understand the reverberations that has set through subsequent centuries and millennia.
And what for you would those reverberations be? This idea of a crucified Messiah, so countercultural, both I suppose to Jewishize and to paganize as being something worthy of honor or exaltation. What did that lead to in terms of the way, in your view, Christianity was distinct from other religions?
I think that at its profoundest, it enshrines at the heart of people's understanding of the divine and therefore the very way that the universe is structured, a conviction that the suffering of the weak and the poor are somehow touched by the divine. And that seems to me a very radical and novel upending of assumptions that prevailed in the time when
would
Christianity
have been
was born.
The similar kind of culture's been saying in that respect.
If you look at even the noblest of Greek philosophers, there is a sort of appreciation that Aristotle's views on slavery are well known. He regards that there are certain people who are fitted by nature to be slaves, but Plato too, what Plato is, in the Republic, he is enshrining a notion that there are people who should probably be entrusted with the running of the state. And that reflects his broader understanding that there is a form of perfection that can be moved to. Now, this is an understanding that, of course, ultimately, it feeds into Christian theology, and that is how Platonism becomes part of the matrix of Christian civilization. Nevertheless, you don't get in either Aristotle or Plato or any other philosopher which I'm aware, perhaps Diogenes, I don't know, but even he is not really the same. This absolute enshrining of the idea that the weak and the poor have not just a moral value, but are in some way touched by the divine. And the long-term implication of that seems to me that it renders cruelty and injustice, as I would define it now, in this Christian world that we still inhabit, problematic, even for the most tyrannical figure. Of course, people continue to do appalling things. They commit atrocities. But there is always that nagging at the back of the mind that, should I be behaving like this?
Am I doing this to are being made in the image of God, in that sense. An idea that, as far as you can see, didn't really exist
in the ancient world, in other ways. I think that it has become so internalised, so taken for granted, that
We speak of human rights.
We speak of the welfare state. Everything that we take for granted as somehow just being part of the natural state of things, it absolutely isn't.
No.
And the reason that we have these assumptions is because we...
So what do you say to
is saturated
to people like A.C. Grayling or other humanists who say, no, that we can arrive at this understanding by a purely secular means, by a sort of rational thought process. We didn't need Christianity to give us that morality. It's something that would have fallen out if we just act rationally.
Well, I mean, who knows? I mean, we are in the world that we are in. Perhaps, a similar understanding would have emerged. Who knows? The fact remains, though, and I find it surprising that it's often evolutionary biologists who oppose this. They seem not to appreciate the fact that ethics and morals and cultural assumptions are just as contingent, just as much the process of evolution as... I don't know, the emergence of Homo sapiens himself.
Yeah.
It seems to me if I can just cut in,
Larry.
One of the things there is that it is speculative to say what might have happened and what might have developed had history gone this way or the other way. But aside from that, it's hard to find, I think, too many other civilizations in human history today and in the past where you have an equivalent set of these moral values enshrined, operative with the same kind of judgmental force. So if it were simply a matter of evolutionary development or other historical forces that could independently produce the same constellation of moral values, then why don't we see other high civilizations in the past or in the present that affirm these values on some other basis? I don't know that we do. Now, it's not at all to deny that high noble ideas and values were invented by Christianity. I mean, some of the Stoic philosophers of the Roman period, such as Musonius Rufus, were espousing high moral values, high ethical values that in some sense resemble some of the values espoused by Christianity as well. But the crucial difference, it seems to me, is that these little circles of philosophical geniuses, so to speak, sat around with their pupils and attempted to shape the behavior of those small circles of students who committed themselves to the discipline of becoming a philosopher.
And who were rich.
Whereas early Christianity took these values and broadcast them and enforce them upon a much wider constituency from the point of baptism onward. And so in terms of historical impact, there seems to me there's just no comparison between the little circles of Stoic philosophers and Christianity.
I mean, one thing that runs through classical philosophy is a kind of highbrow contempt for the masses, for the banausic. And, virtually every philosopher expresses that. And the whole point of philosophy is that it is a marker. It's kind of like going to Eton. It's a marker of your wealth, the fact that you can afford this education, whereas Christianity is radically different in that assumption.
Well, and there was this notion, I think, in certainly amongst the Stoics and others, that, you know, it requires a lot of study and effort and dedication and time to learn to rewire your brain in such a way as to think like a Stoic, because that's not a natural way of thinking. And so, for example, Galen, the very famous physician from the second century, comments somewhat grudgingly about Christians that they haven't done philosophy, they haven't gone through the rigors of philosophical training, but doggone it, they exemplify some of the values
somehow
that
they've
associate with philosophy, and he doesn't quite what to make of that.
It's a really interesting point. I'm going to take a quick break here and we'll come back in a moment's time. Really enjoying this discussion here on Unbelievable today between Tom Holland and Larry Hurtado, both historians in their own fields. Tom publishing all kinds of popular books about the Roman Empire and other ancient empires, but has recently turned his hand really to thinking about the influence of Christianity, early Christianity, which is certainly the area Larry Hurtado, our other guest, has been talking about and writing about for a long time. His new book, Destroyer of the Gods, tells the story of the uniqueness of Christianity in its first century context. When we come back after a quick break, I'm going to get Larry to tell me why Christians were sometimes referred to as atheists in their day, which sounds very odd to us, but I'm sure he'll be able to fill us in on that. And look at some of those objections often levelled at a popular level today to the idea that Western civilization owes much of its morality to Christianity. We'll see what my guests have to say again on that subject. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, the programme that aims to get you thinking here on Premier Christian Radio as part of Faith Explored. Look forward to your comments as well over at the website premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We'll be back in a short moment.
In July 2016, Unbelievable, the conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Briley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Why I Changed My Mind About Christian History. That's what's being discussed on Unbelievable today. Tom Holland is a historian. His books on ancient empires such as Rubicon and In the Shadow of the Sword, and most recently Dynasty, the story of the rise and fall of the House of Caesar, have been very popular. I'm really glad Tom's found the time to come into the studio with me today. But recently in an article for the New Statesman, Tom explained why he himself has changed his mind on Christianity, how he came to regard it as unique in its time and central to the development of modern Western values of equality, dignity, morality. And today he's interacting with Larry Hurtado, Emeritus Professor of New Testament Language, Literature and Theology at the University of Edinburgh, another person I've long wanted to have on the programme. And Larry's new book, Destroyer of the Gods, is available if you want to read on these kinds of issues as well. Don't forget that later on today we'll hear another fascinating story on the profile between 4 and 5 in the afternoon. Look forward to that as we hear a Christian talk about their life and faith journey. If you want to get in touch about today's show, you're also welcome to do that. Again, the email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find links to my guests and places to comment and to share these programmes and subscribe to the podcast from the Unbelievable webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So let's come back to you, Larry, just before we continue the conversation. The book is just really interesting because it delves into all kinds of things many people will be unaware of the bizarre nature to many of their contemporaries of these Christians and this growing movement and what it cost to be a Christian in many ways. One of the interesting things you outline is the fact that Christians were sometimes called by their contemporaries, other pagans, Romans and so on, atheists, which sounds bizarre to us. But why was that in that context?
Well, I think the charge gets right at the heart of what, in my view, was the crucial difference. And that is that the early Christians did not reverence the gods. And in the Roman mind, two things have to be stated. One is that the gods are woven seamlessly through all aspects of social, family, political life. Every structure and virtually every occasion in social and political life rests upon the gods collectively. The second thing is that they seem to have had an all-or-nothing view. That is, you either reverence the gods, each of them as is appropriate when the occasion arises, or you don't reverence gods. And so the early Christians come along and say, we don't reverence the gods. We disregard them as utterly worship, as a bunch, utterly unworthy of worship, in favor of this one God. But that kind of selectivity was bizarre in the eyes of Romans. Now, of course, the Jews practiced a similar kind of cultic exclusivity, but I think the Romans tended to write that off as simply an ethnic peculiarity of Jews.
Mm.
And they could accommodate ethnic peculiarities. So Jewish, in their view, bloody-mindedness about the gods was simply an ethnic peculiarity. But early Christianity quickly became transethnic, with lots of former pagans becoming Christians and seceding, so to speak, from their previous religious activities, seceding from worshiping the gods. And that was what was very disturbing, puzzling, bizarre, and objectionable to Romans. So, and keeping in mind that in the ancient Roman world, it wasn't so much, atheism wasn't so much a matter of belief as it has come to be for us. Today, an atheist is someone who says, I don't believe in a god. But in the ancient world, atheism tended to be whether you worship the gods or not, whether you reverenced or acknowledged them. To refuse to acknowledge a god was, in their mind, effectively to deny the god. And so it was really Christian refusal to join in the worship of the gods that was the real objectionable feature that generated this charge of atheism.
And Christians could be used as sort of scapegoats, by and large, because of this view that they were doing something rather unseemly.
Yes, because, for example, at the level of the family, each family had its household guardian spirits, which the family were to reverence on a daily basis. Each city had its guardian god or goddess who protected the city from plague and from war and disaster. The empire itself rested upon and was represented by, for example, the goddess Roma, and the whole pantheon of deities were invoked as the foundation upon which the Roman Empire rested. So if you denied the validity of those powers on which the social, family, political structures rested, that was about as subversive as you could get.
Mm.
You were challenging the very divine foundations that gave legitimacy to these structures. And as you say, it would be hard to find a more profoundly subversive and dangerous kind of move to make.
Is it surprising at any level, Tom, that such a movement managed to continue, exist and grow in that kind of environment? You know well what the pressures were of that day and age when it came to what was perceived to be correct religious observance and so on.
Well, the success of Christianity at establishing itself obviously encourages one to look and say, well, what was it that made it popular? I mean, I think at the most fundamental level, the fact that it gave dignity to people who hitherto perhaps had not possessed that measure of dignity was clearly, I think, the most significant factor.
And was it in that sense a movement that did appeal to the lower classes, to those who maybe were at the bottom of the social rungs?
I have no doubt about that. Mm. Absolutely no doubt. And I think also what appeals is the fact that for the first time with the church, you start to have something that we might recognise as a welfare state. So that when in the 4th century you have the nephew of Constantine the Great who converts to Christianity, Julian, known as the apostate because he turns his back on his Christian upbringing, he finds it almost impossible, even at that early stage in Christian history, not to imagine that a rival to the Christian church would be a kind of pagan equivalent, one that is providing charity. Mm. There was nothing in the history of pre-Christian religion that would have encouraged that kind of idea.
So that was a radical shift in thinking.
That is quite a radical shift. However, it is also clear that the Christian God provided a very convenient and helpful patron for autocrats who aspired to rule the entire world. Mm. The pretension of the Roman Empire, even though everyone knew that it was a pretension, was that it was sine fine. It was without limit.
Mm.
And clearly, it benefited Constantine enormously because it helped him to ground his own position as ruler of the world by appealing to a cosmic patron that had no rival. And the same thing explains, I think, the appeal of monotheism to the caliphs when Islam emerges. So Christianity works because, as Islam does too, because it appeals to the weak, to the poor. It offers them a sense of justice. It offers them a sense of dignity. But it appeals to the great because it gives them a scope for expressing their would-be global ambitions in a way that other belief systems, other gods simply hadn't done. Yeah. And that explains, I think, why Christianity and Islam between them have been by far the most successful of these religious matrices.
Would you agree broadly with that, Larry?
Yeah, well, I think yes and no. I mean, I think that if we differentiate between the early period, the pre-Constantinian period, which I would do and which my book focuses on, and the ensuing post-Constantinian development.
And just for those who aren't aware of the distinction, Constantine was the one who, as it were, adopted Christianity as the state religion of Rome. And in a sense, that was when Christianity first became truly wedded to political power and so on. So this is very often distinguished.
Yeah, certainly after his coronation in the early 4th century, Constantine legitimates Christianity, lifts it from being an illegitimate to initially a legitimate religion, and then fairly shortly thereafter, it becomes actually the official religion of the Roman Empire. And from that point onward, from the point when he first legitimates Christianity, and begins cozying up, so to speak, to bishops, and bishops start cozying up to the political structures, there is a kind of, in some sense, a dubious marriage that takes place between ecclesiastical power and political power. And I think that the subsequent history of Christianity is a bit more ambiguous, a bit more complicated than it had been in the earlier period. In the earlier period, prior to Constantine's move from the first three centuries, Christianity is a small sect that is growing and living by its own wits. It has no political legitimacy. It has no backing behind it, really. And indeed, in periods, there are outbreaks of official efforts, particularly in the third century, to try to destroy Christianity. So if we look back at that period, I think we really have to say, why on earth, as I say in another recent book that I published earlier this year, why on earth did anybody become a Christian in the first three centuries?
It was a dreadful social cost in a sense.
Particularly social cost. I mean, we have made much often of official state persecution of Christians, which, as modern scholars have emphasized, was actually only now and then, never really systematic or sustained. And it's not so much state-induced martyrdoms that is the big issue. It's really more at the level of family, neighborhood, friends, colleagues, the kind of social ostracism and haranguing and accusations of familial disloyalty or disloyalty to your city that would have been inflicted upon most Christians. What was there to gain? I mean, people talk about and with respect to what Tom was saying, yes, I'm sure that for some of the little people, to have a group in which they were treated as brothers and sisters was meaningful. But there were other groups of the time that also included slaves and free people amongst them, and used brother, sister, familial type language. So Christianity was not unique, I think, in being a kind of cross class based group. But that may have been a factor for some. But if you were in any way a kind of upwardly mobile person or aspired to be an upwardly mobile person, and we know that there were many such people in early Christian circles from the earliest decades onward, if you were such a person wanting and aspiring to have more respect and more stature in the Roman world, why on earth would you become a Christian? That would be the last thing that you would do, because it would only bring opprobrium upon you. So I think that when we look at the growth of early Christianity, we not only have to say, what positive things did it offer? But I think to sharpen the question, we have to say, what positive things were there that were sufficient to outweigh there are quite serious social costs involved.
How do you solve that mystery in the end then, Larry? Well,
it's a bit of a cop-out, but I think, honestly, I think there were probably different reasons for different people. Thomas pointed to, for example, the ennobling, and I think that's a valid point, that the early Christian discourse addressing slaves and treating them and saying to them, you may be a slave, but really you belong to the Lord, and the service that you offer to your earthly master, Christ will take it as offered to him. That at least bestows upon slaves a kind of moral agency. It gives a kind of, some people might say fictive, but for the slave, very real imaginary dignity and nobility to what they're doing, because the word is, you may be serving an earthly master, but Christ will treat your service as given to him. So for those people, that would have been meaningful. But if we look at someone like Justin Martyr from the middle of the second century, he professes that what drew him to Christianity was, after touring about and sampling different philosophical options, he comes across Christianity, he reads the scriptural texts, he talks with a figure, an elderly figure who probably is a Christian himself, and they begin to talk about Christian ideas, and he says he came to realize that this is really the best philosophy. So as far as he's concerned, it was a kind of intellectual or philosophical superiority of Christianity that drew him. And we know that Justin and other people such as Irenaeus and then Tertullian and Origen and others are building a kind of intellectual structure and a defense of Christianity. Athenagoras, people like that, are defending Christianity in philosophical terms in a way that's really quite an impressive and bold intellectual experiment as well.
Tom, anything to add to that in terms of the, I mean, your what you described in that article is the way that community that did develop sort of went on to have this effect that essentially the whole of our society is now shot through with, that we are the inheritors in that sense of what they began.
The thing is that there is a tendency to mistake for human nature the contingent panoply of morals and ethics that we have. I mean, we all do that. But it doesn't take much effort to stand back and recognize that actually our moral and ethical assumptions are bred of a very specific tradition, which I think is Christian. And one way of doing that, for instance, is to look at other ways of seeing the world. So if I mentioned Sparta. Sparta was a model in antiquity, and then after the Renaissance into the Enlightenment. And Sparta was a eugenicist order. Babies were killed who didn't measure up, thrown down a ravine. They were supremacist. The individual was subordinated to the good of the state. This provided a model for people who consciously set themselves against the inheritance of Christian tradition. So in the French Revolution, Saint-Just committed to a particularly sanguinary form of revolutionary justice and violence, was passionately committed to the model of Sparta. So, of course, were the Nazis. Hitler believed that the distinctive Spartan broth originally derived from Schleswig-Holstein. he wanted to identify himself with Sparta. And I think that there is a sense in which really the most honest of atheists, the atheist who has most fully appreciated this, is Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is vastly more honest about this than A.C. Grayling or Dawkins or whoever, because what Nietzsche recognises and condemns in Christianity is what most of us find most appealing about it. So when Nietzsche calls it a slave morality, a slave religion, He's using that as an insult.
Yes.
And he is trying to get back into the mindset of the world before Christianity that would have regarded anything, any association with the world of the weak and the poor as being a cause for contempt and revulsion.
I mean, you've raised the issue of slavery. I mean, something that often gets thrown back if you do say, look at the progress that Christianity has brought and so on and whatever, is, well, in the Gospel and in the New Testament, slavery doesn't exactly get turned back. It's not as though William Wilberforce is there sort of saying all the slaves must be free. There's this kind of collaboration with the institution of slavery, but that's maybe.
But
given
why wouldn't there be? Why would anyone think that anyone have a problem with slavery? I mean, everyone takes slavery for granted.
Yeah, I mean, I guess and it's maybe it's more a question for the theologian than the historian. But the question, I suppose, is, well, shouldn't, if Christianity was this pure religion and shouldn't it have taken a more solid
stand? But it's not
a
pure religion. It's not. I mean, I think it's more of a problem for Islam, to be honest. Because what Islam does that Christianity does not do is maintain the Old Testament notion of God as a legislator who issues laws that are to be followed for all time. And so therefore, the fact that the Quran supports the taking of slaves, that Muhammad is himself, who is a model for all behavior according to Muslim doctrine, owns slaves, that is more of an issue. I'm not a theologian, but I would imagine that the Christian defense to that would be to say that the Holy Spirit works through humanity, works through the fallen souls of humanity, and that therefore the abolition of slavery has made manifest something that was implicit with the scripture. But I'm not a theologian, so I don't know.
But what I do know is that
the idea of enshrining someone who was crucified as God is such a radical upending that, in a sense, the abolition of slavery is kind of implicit
in
that,
like,
shocking
that
strategy.
That was the trajectory that was going to happen. You were going to say something, Larry, sorry.
Yeah, two or three things. One obvious thing is that slavery in the Roman world was much more diverse. I mean, for us, our picture of slavery is probably shaped by, you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin and the horrific situation of black slaves in the American South.
The transatlantic slave trade and so on, yes.
Yeah, and in which they were simply treated as animals. And whereas in the Roman world, slavery could mean anything from that. I mean, you could be condemned to slavery in a brothel or in the mines and treated as merely property. But there were also slaves who were in charge of major households, who were like senior civil servants, you might say, today, who were enjoyed power and their own spending money and their own free time and status and so on. So not all slavery was the same thing. That's the first thing to say. Now, that's not in any way to deny that for many people, slavery was a highly objectionable and demeaning kind of role. But it never occurred to anybody in the ancient world that you could abolish slavery. I mean, even someone like Epictetus, an early Roman-era writer, philosopher in the sort of Cynic-Stoic tradition, he had himself been a slave and was set free. And what does he do as soon as he's set free and has a means to do so? He acquires slaves. So it doesn't occur to anybody that you could abolish slavery. And to imagine that a small Christian sect itself oppressed and receiving opprobrium could somehow engineer legislative change in the operation of slavery is, of course, silly. What the early Christians do exhibit, though, in the New Testament texts and onward, is an ennobling, as I said before, an ennobling of the slave as a full brother or sister, as a full equal child of God, and as someone who could make their slavery a gift to God. You can't legally escape your slavery, perhaps. The law confines you to that, and there's nothing that can be done about that. But you can transcend it, so to speak, in your imagining of who you are. The other thing to say, of course, is that by the second century, we know that Christian churches were banding together, accumulating money in order to buy the freedom of slaves,
right,
in order to purchase their liberty.
Yeah.
So there were steps taken, both the ennobling of slavery, the transferring it from its utterly demeaned status to something more noble. One of the passages, for example, that is interesting in this light is a passage in the book of Revelation in the New Testament, where the author cites and condemns the evil political economic system of the day, which is fairly transparently the Roman system. And he speaks of them as, you know, people who engage in this buying and selling of gold and silver and various sort of fine luxury items. Goes on down through a list that goes into wood and ordinary commodities, and it winds up with slaves, that is, the souls of men. So he lists the bill of lading, so to speak, and the final term, slaves there, by the way, is the Greek word somata, bodies, which is the way people referred to slaves, is simply bodies. And then he says, but these are the souls of men. So what you regard as mere bodies, he says, we regard as living souls that belong to God. There you have something of the attitude and standpoint that raises questions that make slavery at least more ambiguous than it had ever been before.
We're coming towards the end of our time together. There's something I have wanted to ask you the whole time, Tom, which is on a more personal level, but you end your piece for the New Statesman saying, today, even as belief in God fades across the West, the countries that were once collectively known as Christendom continue to bear the stamp of the 2-millennia-old revolution that Christianity represents. It is the principal reason why, by and large, most of us who live in post-Christian societies still take for granted that it is nobler to suffer than to inflict suffering. It's why we generally assume that every human life is of equal value. In my morals and ethics, I have learned to accept that I am not Greek or Roman at all, but thoroughly and proudly Christian. And that leaves the question, are you at this point sort of convinced that, yes, my moral leanings and that side of who I am is Christian and I can't deny that? But has that not quite transferred into the beliefs in God and the divine nature of Christ and so on?
I began by mentioning dinosaurs, and in the New Statesman article I described the first shadow of doubt that fell across me when I was at Sunday school. I must have been about 5 or 6, and there was a illustrated Bible with Adam and Eve and a brachiosaur, and I knew that Adam and Eve and I knew that humans
they
had never seen
it.
That has always been a problem for me, not because I take the Genesis account literally and I think that that is an issue, but simply because when I contemplate the vastness and immensity of geological time, and I think about the asteroid that smacked into planet Earth and incinerated all the dinosaurs, and I think of how many species have come and gone. I think of the tininess of our Earth in the context of the vastness of the universe, and then I'm asked to think God.
Right. So there's still
there is a tension there that shadow of disbelief is still thick over me. However, I also recognise that when I have experience of the sublime, when I have a sense of something beyond me, that is Christian. And that there is nothing that I find more moving, really, than the narrative of the Passion and the Resurrection. And perhaps that is still a faint guttering flame of faith that is there to be tended and may become a more fuller flame in due course.
It's been lovely having you on the programme today, Tom. Thank you very much. Larry, also, thank you for being with us. People are able to get hold of your book, of course. I'll make sure there's links from today's show to it, The Destroyer of the Gods. And it's been just a lovely, fascinating conversation and really helpful in tracing some of the historical aspects of what our culture owes today to that first fledgling Christian movement. But Tom and Larry, thank you for being with me on the programme today.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, still to come here on Unbelievable, going to be telling you about a couple of events coming up in the near future. Can we agree to disagree? Christians and humanists in dialogue. I'll be involved in an event that will be chaired by BBC broadcaster Nick Ross on Monday, the 14th of November. A bit more detail on that to come. And also an exciting conference happening in Cambridge on the future of biology and science on Saturday, the 12th of November. Stephen Meyer and Professor David Galloway, I'll be speaking to them after a short break about that.
40 years ago, four teenagers met in a kitchen in Dublin and decided to form a band. Since then, U2 have conquered the rock world and never been afraid to sing about God while doing so. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we chart their four-decade spiritual journey and the impact they've had on the global church. Plus, we talk to Eric Metaxas on why he's backing Trump. We explore the rise of the true crime documentary and find new ways to pray. All that plus much more. Make sure you pick up a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back. This is the programme Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley. This is the show where Christians and non-Christians often come together for dialogue and debate. Also, quite a few Christians from different theological perspectives and loads of interesting shows that are going to be coming your way, whether you're listening via radio or podcast or online. Things like Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, is going to be with me for two editions of the show in the next few weeks. He took your questions and we're going to be hearing what you had to ask him in a special Ask Tom Wright Anything show, and then he's going to be debating the premise of his new book on the atonement, The Day the Revolution Began, and that's with US Bible scholar Tom Schreiner, who takes a different view to N.T. Wright on various aspects of the atonement. So that should be an interesting one. Tim Keller's coming on the show. He's a well-known pastor out in New York, pastor to the skeptics in many ways with his ministry in Manhattan at Redeemer Church there. He's got a new book called Making Sense of God, and he's going to be in conversation with a skeptic about that. And sticking with the U.S., the US elections, of course, coming up, and we're going to be doing a debate on Trump and Hillary and all of that stuff. So lots of interesting stuff to whet your appetite for in the future. Just another thing that I'd like to let you know about right now, which is a special event that I'm involved with, along with the British Humanist Association, Premier Christian Radio and the British Humanist, getting together to put on a dialogue event. Can we agree to disagree? This is something special for Interfaith Week, which starts, I think, on Sunday, the 13th of November. Well, on the Monday, the 14th of November, you can come along to this special dialogue event. It's happening at Conway Hall in London from 7 till 9 in the evening. Tickets are just £6, so it's a great thing to come along to if you're interested in how we can engage each other better. We're not going to be debating the existence of God and that kind of thing, but we're going to be talking about how we have those discussions, how we have dialogues about public issues as well, like I'm sure sexuality and that kind of thing will come up in the course of the conversation. Doors open, as I say, at 7. Event starts at 7:30. The chair is Nick Ross. He's a distinguished broadcaster and journalist. And the speaker panel, there's going to be two speakers on each side of this dialogue. Andrew Copson, he's no stranger to this programme. He's a chief executive of the British Humanist Association. And with him, Pavan Dhaliwal. She's also a director of public affairs and policy at the BHA. I'll be there, Premier Christian Radio's host of Unbelievable, speaking alongside Chinny MacDonald. She's from the Evangelical Alliance, their director of communications. And yes, we're going to be looking at the whole issue of how we disagree agreeably. And can we do it any better when it comes to these dialogues in the public sphere? Again, if you want more details, you want to book yourself in, register for this event, there's an event at the eventbrite.com website that you can do that at. Just look for Can We Agree to Disagree? Christians and Humanists in Dialogue. And again, that's Monday, the 14th of November in the evening. We're going to be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme. But before we do that, I've got two guests to join me now. They're going to be telling us about another event coming up on Saturday, the 12th of November.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's great to be joined on the programme now by two special people to talk about a very important conference coming up, the Beyond Materialism Conference in Cambridge on Saturday, the 12th of November. It's called Beyond Materialism, Biology for the 21st Century. And it's going to be a number of speakers, some of whom are from the Discovery Institute in Seattle, in America, and particularly on the whole area of whether a naturalistic framework can explain the nature of the life we see around us. It'll be of interest for those who are interested in the whole field of intelligent design. And it's great to be joined on the line by both Dr. Steve Mayer, who's well known as a philosopher of science, author of Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt. He's been on the programme a number of times before.
And also welcoming for the first time Professor David Galloway from the College of Physicians and Surgeons, who's one of the people behind the conference as well. A very warm welcome to the programme, both gentlemen. We'll start with you, Steve. You're coming over to the UK again. Many people know you as one of the leading proponents of what's often called intelligent design. Tell us a little bit about what you've been up to recently, Steve, and what you expect to be talking about at this year's conference.
Well, there's been a kind of explosive growth in the interest in the theory of intelligent design over the last several years. In my last book, Darwin's Doubt, I documented the increasing ferment that's taking place within mainstream evolutionary biology, many leading evolutionary biologists now calling for a new theory of evolution, rejecting the standard textbook neo-Darwinism that has been promulgated by figures like Richard Dawkins in your country or Jerry Coyne in ours. And many, I think, people within the mainstream field of evolutionary biology are increasingly dissatisfied with the theory, looking for a new approach. We want to suggest in the conference that it may be time to abandon that naturalistic framework and look at design as not only an effect but also as a cause, that there is evidence of agency and intelligence in the digital code and the hierarchical organization of information that we see in living systems and many other things. And we have an extraordinary lineup of people coming to the conference, from paleontologists from Germany, a population geneticist from Sweden, several excellent scientists from the UK, and a number of the leading proponents of intelligent design from the United States as well.
One of the people coming, I know, is Doug Axe, who's a colleague of yours, of course. I know he's got a new book out, and Doug's field particularly is obviously molecular biology and proteins. So do you want to just very quickly give a boiled down explanation of what Doug's going to be talking about?
Well, right, Doug, as you may remember, I know you've had him on the program, was trained at Caltech, did a PhD there in chemical engineering with an emphasis on topics in molecular biology, and then did a long 14-year research stint at University of Cambridge in protein science. And he's written a new book called Undeniable, and the subtitle is How Our Design Intuition Has Been Confirmed by Modern Biology. And he argues that we all have this intuition. Richard Dawkins speaks of it in The Blind Watchmaker when he says that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And Doug argues that that appearance is not just an appearance. It's not an illusion, as the Darwinists want to say, but actually the evidence from biology supports that strong intuition. And he has been studying the difficulty of transforming even two closely aligned proteins by the mutation selection mechanism, and has given a precise mathematical quantification of that difficulty. And so there's some really exciting developments in being able to evaluate the Darwinian claims mathematically and with precision. And Doug is doing that at the level of proteins. A new paleontologist who's come into our ranks from Germany, Günter Beckley, is going to be looking at the fossil record, also looking at the mathematical plausibility of generating the amount of morphological change that we see in the fossil record within a time available as documented by the record. So there's some, I think, interesting ways in which biology is being married with mathematical analysis to give a lot more precise way of looking at these questions.
It sounds like it's going to be really cutting-edge stuff. I want to come back to you in a moment, Steve, to talk about, obviously, the controversy that this whole area raises. But one of the people who won't be at the conference, but is certainly supporting the conference as one of the sort of people behind it, David Galloway, also joins us on the line. David, you're a professor. You're well-respected within your field. But this is a controversial area very often for many people, intelligent design. What's led you to kind of be supporting this kind of a conference and the kinds of things it's putting forward?
Well, I think one of the key things, Justin, is that in our field, just as in every other field of modern science, the sort of governing direction is dictated by what appears to be the weight of evidence. And so when you look at the evidence that would support what appears to be the presumed strength of a kind of Darwinian position, the evidence honestly is really found wanting. And so Steve talked a little bit about this and talked about some of the evidence, but in reality, the evidence that is there is almost certainly an illusion that it's sufficient to explain what is dependent on. And so because of that lack of secure evidence and the strong suggestion that the illusion of design, so-called, is actually not an illusion at all, but is a reality, that makes us just very keen to call the whole thing into the public domain and to make sure that we properly explore the area.
What do you say to critics who say intelligent design isn't science? It's anti-science, in fact, because it sort of is saying, you know, we shouldn't keep looking for a natural solution. We have to say something else did it, something we can't possibly understand.
Well, for a start, I mean, I think the claim that people make that this is not science will be governed by your definition of science. If what you're looking for is a true explanation, then we need to explore the entire scene. And one of the issues really relates to the fact that a definition of science that says that you must not explore certain areas that might well give you a perfectly good and indeed true understanding of, for example, the origin of life or the origin of information in life, to edit that possible explanation out of your thinking just seems to be completely perverse and bizarre. I think we need to try and seek the truth here, and if the truth doesn't fit with some individual's understanding of what is acceptable as a scientific definition, then I think their position is inadequate. The reality is, I think, that the design hypothesis is very much on the table, and we need to be looking at that as critically and as carefully as we possibly can.
Okay, well, the lineup of speakers, as Steve said, is very impressive. Steve, you've mentioned Doug. Dr. Paul Nelson is going to be there on History and Philosophy of Science. Dr. Anne Gauger, is it?
It's Gauger, yes, Gauger. A molecular biologist, MIT, University of Washington, Harvard-trained. Jeff Barnard, a former Cambridge University researcher in biochemistry in the veterinary medicine department. He's now living in Israel, but is coming back to Cambridge for this event. Alistair Donald, a British environmental scientist, who is also holds a PhD in theology. So he's going to be talking about some of the science and faith questions and the intersection there. So it's a really terrific lineup. And Doug Axe will be there talking about his new book, as well as his research on the difficulty of evolving one protein to another.
Yeah.
I just wanted to piggyback, though, on what David was just saying. It maybe a simple way of getting at this: if you walk into the British Museum and you go to the Assyrian room, or you look at the Rosetta Stone, and you ask yourself the question, well, how do those interesting inscriptions arise? And you think, well, I must explain them by reference to a purely materialistic explanation. You're obviously going to miss something. If you say, well, it must have been something like wind and erosion, when you know full well there was a mind responsible for the production of those information-rich inscriptions, you're going to miss reality. And this is what we think materialism does, is that we are now finding inside living systems digital code, hierarchically arranged information processing systems, miniature machines, nanotechnology, hallmarks of what are called design patterns in computer science, specific ways of organizing information, metadata. It's extraordinary the hallmarks of intelligent programming we're finding in the genome. And in a sense, there's a growing number of scientists internationally who are saying, we don't want to be bound by the conventions of 19th century science and try to force a square peg into a round hole. We want to be free to follow the evidence where it leads, even if it leads us to the conclusion that a designing intelligence played a role in the origin of life. And so we're exploring that, and exploring not only the power of the design explanation for data that we already have as we study biology and life, living systems, but also what philosophers call the heuristic value of the hypothesis. We're also going to be looking at and talking about some of the testable hypotheses and insights that design brings as we go forward in studying biology. It's not just explaining what we know already, it's also generating new hypotheses that will guide biology in the future.
Well, it all sounds really interesting. It's happening Saturday, the 12th of November, so not far away. And if you want to find out more, register for the conference, go to c4id.org.uk. Again, that's C4, as in the numeral 4, ID.org.uk. So it's a conference being put on by the Centre for Intelligent Design UK, Beyond Materialism, Biology for the 21st Century, Hughes Hall in Cambridge on Saturday the 12th of November. I'm looking forward to, hopefully, as you know, we like to host the discussion on this programme, Steve, and Doug, I believe, is going to make himself available while he's over in the UK. So I'm looking forward to hearing about his new book and hearing his ideas tested in a kind of public debate as well on this programme. But I really appreciate you coming on at your time in the US, and also for David for joining us for this conversation, and all the very best for the conference.
Thank you very much. Always great to be on with you, Justin.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'm glad we've got space over the last few shows, and I'm sure in future editions to have a proper look at some of your feedback that's been coming in on various topics that we've covered on the programme recently. You can, of course, email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk if you want to send me an email. I would say try to keep them on the shorter side, and they'll stand more chance of being read, because it's harder to read out very long emails and to cut them down if I do want to try and read them. But I appreciate it when people are shortened to the point where they can be. But if you want to get in touch as well on social media, send me a message or post something on the page, follow the website, follow the programme that way. You can do that at UnbelievableJB is my Twitter handle, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show there. All of those links are available, of course, from the website. And today's show, you can actually comment on that as well if you'd like to. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And of course, a reminder that if you haven't yet accessed it and you'd like to have a look, the Unbelievable DVD from this year's conference, as well as the digital download, is available there as well. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Regular commenter underneath programmes is Tara. Says, just a thought for a show topic. How about a philosophical debate on scientism? It's a word theists use as derogatory. Well, there's actually more to it, in my humble opinion. Perhaps you could tackle it philosophically at some point. Opposing guests on whether we've become a society too focused on the authority of science. Thank you very much for the suggestion, Tara. Scott got in touch via Facebook to say, just wanted to write a quick note. I've been poring through the podcast and have been really enjoying them. One thing that comes to mind when you have people on who either lost their faith or maybe came to faith, they usually talk about the research they did. As a Bible degree graduate, I wonder where and how they go about their research. How do they know who they're reading is a credible source? A popular saying around my house is that Google knows everything. It's a joke, we like to say, because we know it's not true. My fear is that some people lose their faith because they Google their questions and read publications that may or may not be credible. I'm not sure if there's a way to talk about that on the show, but it may be interesting to have a couple of scholars talking about proper research, especially in regard to something that's hugely important, faith. Thanks for what you do. I just purchased the Unbelievable Conference digital content and excited to watch it. Take care, Scott. Thank you very much, Scott. Appreciate you getting in touch. Yes, I'm not sure if I would devote a whole show to that, but I think next time we have some, you know, scholars in, and that seems appropriate, maybe we can bring it up in the conversation. Carrie wants to talk about the multiverse, and we had the second part of two shows dedicated to looking at that frankly sometimes baffling scientific concept, and how much evidence there is for it, whether it's a problem for the view of fine-tuning of the universe, and whether that's a problem as far as its evidential value for God. And so we've had a number of different contributors, and last week, of course, Max Andrews and Luke Barnes were my guests on the show. But going back to the first one, which was Jeff Swearing and Skydive Phil, Carrie wanted to say how much she enjoyed that episode of the show and how apt I thought it was that one of the hymns we sang in my church the following day was the well-known old classic, All My Hope on God Is Founded, which contains these lines: beauty springeth out of naught, evermore from his store, newborn worlds rise and adore. Seems to me that the multiverse wasn't a problem for this Victorian hymn writer, and he sure got a head start on the scientist. Yes, I'd agree, Carrie. I don't think that the multiverse as a concept is a problem for God. You know, if God wants to create a billion other universes. That's entirely up to God, and I don't think the Bible particularly affirms or denies that. I guess the problem that we were elucidating was whether it's a problem for the fine-tuning argument as an argument for the existence of God. I really enjoyed those shows because I got into a whole subject that I really hadn't known much about before. And my feeling is I'm agnostic on the multiverse. I'm not convinced because I think there is quite a lot more evidence that needs to happen to kind of move from this inflationary model, for which there seems to be good evidence, to the corollary of the multiverse, which for me feels like, you definitely got to have more to get there. That was my takeaway from it. And so I personally feel the fine-tuning argument still stands in good stead. I think there, I would agree with what Luke Barnes said, that even if you've got a multiverse, you've still got a heck of a lot of fine-tuning for the process that brought that into if you're talking about this inflationary model, at least, that has to be there to start with. Bruce says, it does seem to be strange you've had on one program two Christians who believe in the multiverse, i.e. unicorns in the sky, and then the next week you have two Christians who clearly don't believe in such mathematical nonsense. Bruce, I'm not sure. I think Max Andrews was pretty sold on the multiverse last week. It was really Luke Barnes who was the more sceptical of the two when it came to multiverse theory. Says, it's a pity you didn't have two Christians who have different views on the elegant universe. That would have been more interesting to listen to. All right, thank you, Bruce. And Ian says, interesting and perplexing programs on the multiverse. However, I think that like wives, one is enough for anyone. With all the fine-tuning debates and your own recent video, there is something that concerns me. There seems to be an implicit assumption that anything that can happen by chance. Well, that's simply not true, and so some of the argumentation is invalid. Consider the following situations. First, suppose there is a pile of rubble. Now, how the pile of rubble assumed its particular configuration is a matter of chance, though that does leave aside the matter of why it's there at all. And now consider a house. The only way the house can be there is by design. It's not just that it's highly improbable for it to appear by chance. It is that it could only appear by design. Okay. I appreciate what you're saying there, Ian. I think the point is that yes, of course, if you just dumped a pile of rubble, the chances are it's just going to look like a big pile of rubble. And that's because the chances of it dumping in such a way that it happened to stack up to create a house are so tiny of that actually happening. But the point being that if you did it and potentially infinite number of times, at some point it will happen to fall in such a way that it'll create a house. And that's the whole idea of the multiverse is it puts your chances at an infinite number, effectively. But that's the whole question, you know. Otherwise, yeah, of course, these things are tiny chances, and that's the whole idea of the fine-tuning, I suppose. But Tim Boyle in Japan, a regular show listener, Tim, says, I'm sure your brain was spinning as was mine, trying to follow everything on the podcast of round two of the multiverse. Not only is there the paradox of Boltzmann brains in cosmology, there's also the often-used term of brain, B-R-A-N-E, as well, to further confuse things. Such brains and brains, A-N-E-S, are the bane of my brain when trying to figure it all out. One thing that bothers me about this Boltzmann brain concept is that it doesn't even touch on the mind-brain issue. I gather it simply assumes some sort of physicalism that views the mind and brain as the same thing. I'd like to hear a discussion on that added to the mix. Boltzmann brains are described as self-aware entities that somehow just emerge from the chaos due to a fluctuation. Well, I understand that the concept is simply a conceptual tool being used and that cosmologists aren't thinking in literal terms of self-aware entities popping into existence randomly around the universe, or at least I hope no one's thinking that. But maybe I suggest that even if there are, maybe we might not better term them Boltzmann minds. If you are a dualist, as I am, then that makes a whole lot more sense, as such an entity would not require a complicated physical structure as a literal brain. Keep up the good work and continue to stimulate our brains. I mean, minds, says Tim. Thank you, Tim. Lots of interesting stuff that came out of that show, and we'll, I'm sure, continue to have more feedback to it as we go along. Maybe time for one more. Paul McCauley in Belfast. I did have some more emails lined up on Darren Brown. I had some really interesting ones reflecting on the whole issue of miracles, particularly one fascinating one, rather long, but I do want to give it time, so maybe next week, from a Christian doctor called Brian, who got in touch about what he believes he's seen and heard about that would provide, you know, pretty compelling miracle evidence in the face of Darren Brown's scepticism over miracles. So we'll leave that till next week. But just Paul out in Belfast says, really enjoyed the discussion between Ryan and Sean, the unbelievable live discussion that took place in California. Lots of things came up that deserve comment. I just want to mention three of them. First, Ryan said that his opposition to racism was based on the fact that if we want humans to flourish, we shouldn't be racist. But this means racism isn't morally bad, it's just not sensible. Yet Ryan knows that when he encounters racism, he isn't encountering something merely unhelpful, he's encountering something evil. But atheism can't provide a basis for calling anything evil. Second, he makes the mistake almost everyone makes in critiquing the moral argument. He responded as if the moral argument states that you need to believe in God to know good and evil. But the second premise of the moral argument, that objective moral values do exist, presupposes that people do know good and evil. The point is, if only physical reality exists, then nothing is objectively actually evil. Third, he said that Dennett and Harris could be right, that consciousness is an illusion. Well, if consciousness is the state of being aware, how can one be aware that being aware is an illusion? Brain-boggling stuff. Thank you, Paul. We aim to boggle the brain on Unbelievable, but I hope some sense comes out of it in the process. And thank you for listening to today's programme. And if you want to get in touch yourself, as ever, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Always the best way to reach me, but do enjoy reading your comments on Facebook, social media, and everywhere else as well. And I hope you can come back again at the same time next week. For the moment, thanks for being with me. Let me tell you what's coming up.
You're unbelievable.
We're revisiting the subject of hell on next week's programme. There's been the Rethinking Hell conference in London over this weekend, and I'm going to be joined by the public face of Rethinking Hell, Chris Date, for a conversation on what Revelation has to say about hell. Chris takes the view that hell is not a place of everlasting torment, but rather that it's a place of annihilation, a final end. Whereas my other guest, Rob Wiesner, is going to be defending the view of eternal conscious punishment. But what does Revelation have to say, and how should we interpret the book of Revelation anyway? Should be an interesting program next week at the same time. See you then.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.